This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to talk about Jim Bruton, whose work is all around you. My slides pale into comparison with the real thing. So if you see something you like, go see the real thing after I talk. This paper traces the trajectory of the Philadelphia-based artist James Edward Bruton's career from his discharge from military service as a Marine sergeant in 1954 to his death by suicide in May 1967. A fascinating yet all too under-recognized artist today, Bruton was born in Toledo, Ohio on November 4, 1930, and attended his first art classes at the Toledo Art Museum before enlisting in the United States Marine Corps in 1951 and serving in the Korean War, an experience that made him an outspoken pacifist and anti-war activist for the rest of his life. However, the bulk of his artistic training took place after 1954, when he returned from the Korean War and enrolled at the Ruskin School of Drawing and Fine Art in Oxford, England, on the GI Bill. In the summer of 1955, Bruton transferred to the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia, where he completed his studies in 1958. In the following year, Bruton's precocious talent was recognized when his painting, The Suicide of Judas, won the $1,000 J. Henry Scheidt Memorial Prize at the Pennsylvania Academy's annual exhibition. As Dorothy Graffley, the art critic for the Philadelphia Bulletin, duly noted, the tall ex-Marine sergeant thus captured at the age of 28 the same award that William Glacken, Stuart Davis, Hans Hoffman, Ivan Albright, and Charles Birchfield had earned in their maturity. Bruton's artistic training coincided with the heyday of abstract expressionism, when art students were encouraged to create large-scale gestural abstractions that built upon but did not extend the powerful legacy of American painters of the previous generation, such as Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, and Mark Rothko. Rather than doom himself to an unfulfilling career as a second-generation abstract expressionist painter, Bruton found inspiration in the iconoclastic writings of Alfred Jarry, as mediated through the powerful figure of the polemical Danish artist, writer, and theorist Asger Jorn, who was a key figure in the revival of interest in Jarryan pataphysics after the Second World War. From the spring of 1962 and well into 1963, Bruton lived in Jorn's hometown of Silkeborg in the Danish province of Jutland. Accompanied by his partner, the novelist Barbara Holland, then pregnant with his daughter Emily, who was born in Denmark in September 1962, and is sitting in our midst, Bruton arrived unannounced at the trout farm of the painter and ceramicist Erik Nyholm and his wife Janet. Despite the lack of advance warning about their visit, the young couple were warmly welcomed into the artistic community of Silkeborg and began renting their own farmhouse, which doubled as a studio. It was through the Nyholms that Bruton met Jorn, and the American artist's paintings from this time, such as Self-Portrait in Blue and Green, reveal the lessons that he learned from the Danish artist. Prior to Bruton's arrival, Jorn had vociferously rejected abstract expressionism, arguing that, quote, "the conception of art implicit in action painting reduces art to an act in itself, in which the object, the work of art, is a mere trace, and in which there is no more communication with the audience. This is the attitude of the pure creator who does nothing but fulfill himself through the materials for his own pleasure," end quote. Seeking to produce artworks that operated centrifugally, projecting outwards towards culture and the social, as opposed to what he viewed as the centripetal movement of the inward-looking, self-absorbed abstract expressionists, Jorn adopted the strategies of parody and pastiche to create artworks that engage with critical ideas and lived experience. The impact of Jorn's ideas can be seen in the powerful sensory address of Bruton's subsequent paintings, including the use of bold, broad brushstrokes, vibrant color, and heavy pigmentation, in which the paint was often pressed straight out of the tube and smeared across the canvas in a similar manner to the Danish artist's paintings. And I'm showing you here the remarkable Wallflower of 1958. Like Jorn, Bruton was highly responsive to the physical properties of oil paint, and the frenetic energy and raw emotional power of Self-Portrait in Blue and Green stems from its rejection of the fine art traditions that have been so powerfully ingrained in him at the Pennsylvania Academy, in line with the artistic de-skilling and refusal of finish and good taste, what Jorn called artification, that the Danish artist had promoted in the previous two decades through his involvement as an important catalyst within numerous international avant-garde groups, including Cobra, a European collective whose name originated from the original, from the initial letters of Copenhagen, Brussels, and Amsterdam, Cobra, and the Situationist International. Unlike the vast majority of American artists of his generation, Bruton had first-hand knowledge of these European art movements through Jorn and Nyholm, and shared their interest in the subversive writings of Alfred Jarry, as well as their commitment to collectivism, their insistence on the political implications of the art-making process, and the rejection of a single style or an artistic vision that reified objects and relationships. As Bruton would argue in the brochure that accompanied an exhibition of his work in Copenhagen in May 1965, "I think style in art is injurious to anyone who likes freedom of movement. The people in Denmark who know my work will find it changed. I would rather innovate than live in the comfort of a manor." This statement echoes similar pronouncements by Jorn and his colleagues in the Situationist International and underscores the liberating effect of Bruton's exposure to their radical ideas in the early 1960s, including the notion that artists should create situations that consisted of constructed encounters and creatively lived moments to agitate and polemicize against the sterility and oppression of the actual environment and ruling economic and political systems. Bruton initially found inspiration in the monstrous dictatorial character of King Ubu, who inspired a number of paintings that he made around 1962, such as Ubu Becomes King, which was painted on a piece of fabric that had a pre-existing spiral design and reveals the artist's knowledge of Jarry's own graphic representations of King Ubu, including the 1896 woodcut that the French writer called the true portrait of Monsieur Ubu. In the relief painting Ubu's Military Mind, which Bruton also completed that year, the artist drew upon his own military experience, which had exposed him to the mind-numbing absurdity of the military's rules and regulations that Jarry had also satirized to great effect in the Ubu plays and many of his other writings. Whether describing his debraining machines or the brute animal-like instincts of King Ubu, Jarry's tone always remained clipped and inhumanly pompous, much like the official language of the military that Bruton knew so well. In Ubu's Military Mind, King Ubu defecates a sharpshooter medal that may have belonged to Bruton's friend Barry Promus, who was an army sharpshooter during the Vietnam War, while his own Korean service medal was placed above Ubu's belly. You can see it. It's got three bronze stars on it. And another military medal, possibly Jim's or someone else's, was placed inside his belly. The inclusion of military medals and insignia in this portrait conforms to Jarry's own notion of King Ubu as the direct embodiment of the deeply ingrained, unconscious, abject, and libidinal forces that we all carry within us, hence the pear-shaped body that gives Ubu the appearance of a giant turd. By equating military service medals with shit, Bruton was clearly aware that the scandalous nature of the Ubu plays lay precisely in their appropriation of the grotesque and scatological qualities of folk puppetry, as seen in King Ubu's toilet scepter brush. You can see it, it's sort of in his pocket there. An enormous protruding belly, the symbol of his insatiable greed and stupidity. Bruton was especially interested in Asger Jorn's Scandinavian Institute for Comparative Vandalism, which the Danish artist began in 1962, and upon his return to Philadelphia in 1964, he founded the J.E. Bruton Institute of Comparative Vandalism in an effort to bring Jorn's ideas to the United States through posters, stamps, and publications bearing the organization's grandiloquent title. Comparative vandalism was, of course, informed by Marcel Duchamp's iconoclastic 1919 rectified ready-made Elle Chaux de Coux, in which the French Dadaist altered and transformed a cheap chrome lithograph of Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa through the addition in pencil of an upturned mustache and a rakish goatee, And of course, as you all know, when you sound those letters out, Elo Shodokou becomes she has a hot ass, or as Duchamp sometimes liked to say, there's fire below. Another source for comparative vandalism was Duchamp's provocative suggestion in one of his Green Box notes that a Rembrandt painting could be used as an ironing board. And Bruton made direct reference to this. This is one of my favorite works of his called Irony Board. So he's steeped not only in Géry, but in Duchamp, and you'll see at the back there the trebuchet sort of, it functions as a coat rack here, but it could actually sit on the floor like Duchamp's. Comparative vandalism was also inspired by Géry's pataphysics. The Scandinavian Institute for Comparative Vandalism, Jorn explained, is an attempt to prove that much so-called science is based on the most absurd and narrow-minded prejudices. Believing the same to be true of art, Jorn refused to represent Denmark at the 1962 Venice Biennale and worked instead on a series of modified paintings that he called defigurations, which were painted over pre-existing oil paintings that he found in antique shops and flea markets. These amateur works, which were often chosen for their highly sentimental or kitsch value, were then transformed by Jorn's vibrant and at times aggressive overpainting, which usually included painterly scrawls suggested of demonic figures and primeval monsters. Remarkably, Jorn's additions reinvigorated the original works, whose style and content often appeared homogenous and altogether natural when seen alongside, or rather underneath, Jorn's painterly daubs, despite the radical differences in technique and brushwork. In the 1962 painting Faustrol, for example, an image of a smiling bearded man appears at the center of a recycled painting, surrounded by monstrous grinning creatures, no doubt intended to invoke the tortured imagination of Dr. Faustrol, Alfred Géry's pataphysical alter ego. Ralph Romney, an English painter and friend and colleague of Jorn in the Situationist International in the late 1950s, has connected works like Faustrol with the situationist notion of détournement, or rerouting, which is a method of changing or modifying either the context or the nature of a presently existing cultural object so that it acquires a new and higher significance. This statement provides a deeper context in which to understand what at first glance might seem a gratuitous act of vandalism by Jorn against a harmless Franz Hals-like portrait of a happy-go-lucky gentleman. As a situationist détournement, the pre-existing painting can indeed be seen to have acquired a new and higher significance through the Danish artist's graffiti-like additions, which add an atmosphere of mystery and solemnity to the portrait, as well as the title which identifies the bearded rogue with the eponymous hero of Alfred Géry's posthumously published masterpiece. In a manifesto issued in defense of the active critical vandalism of these found canvases, Jorn declared with a pataphysical logic worthy of Géry himself, and I say this as a museum director, and you've got to imagine this language being like an advert on TV. The situationists really understood advertising and the society of the spectacle. So this is Jorn. Be modern, you collectors and museums. If you have old paintings, do not despair. Retain your memories, but deturn them so that they can correspond with your own era. Painting is over. You might as well finish it off. Deturn them. Long live painting. Bruton employed similar tactics in his own deturn works. As seen in the 1964 print called Sunrise, in which a recycled image from a French fashion magazine of a bikini-clad woman having her breast groped is deterred to become a statement on the sexual revolution of the 1960s. Her half-joyful, half-shocked expression adds a layer of ambiguity to the work, since we have no way of knowing if the surprised girl slaps the man's face in return for his impromptu actions or submits to his sexual advances. As with the best of Jorn's deterred paintings, Bruton utilized what he was already given in this work, but added so much of his own personality and humor, including his blue graffiti pataphysique stamp that bears his initials between an Ubu-esque spiral, and you can see here, this is the woodcut on which it's based, to make what, in the end, is a highly original work of art. Made in 1964, the year after Bruton returned from his first stay in Denmark, the outrageously funny, sexy, irresponsible, and liberating Sunrise speaks to his ambition to bring the revolutionary ideas he encountered in Silkeborg back to Philadelphia. And we have the artist proof for that in the exhibition, which is filled with a lot more of those kind of graffiti scrawls and stamps that he loves so much. Graffiti Pataphysique, which Bruton used as the title of his solo exhibition at Harry Kolkowitz's Kenmore Galleries in Philadelphia in February 1965, drew upon the liberating example of Jorn's Scandinavian Institute for Comparative Vandalism, which, as we have seen, was directly inspired by the Danish artist's understanding of Jerry's pataphysics, as well as the remarkable graffiti that Bruton saw in urban Philadelphia, which held a strong fascination for him in its direct, raw, untutored expression, as well as its outsider status as an unsanctioned, often illegal art form. In the exhibition brochure, Bruton also claimed that his interest in graffiti stemmed from its anonymous nature, which made it available for all mankind, the subject of many of his stamps, for all mankind, as opposed to modern art, which he saw as being only available to a privileged few. However, Bruton's defense of graffiti in the Kenmore Gallery's exhibition brochure quickly turned into an evocation of Alfred Jarry's pataphysics, hence the title Graffiti Pataphysique. So this is Bruton. Graffiti are found on walls and pavements the world over, scribbled inscriptions or drawings. Pataphysics is the science of the realm beyond metaphysics, or pataphysics lies as far beyond physics as physics lies beyond addition, in one direction or another. It is the science of imaginary solutions, the science of the particular, of laws governing exceptions. The pataphysician is concerned not through engagement in an attempt to create human values, but in the manner of a child looking through a kaleidoscope. Perhaps the most startling work in Bruton's 1965 exhibitions was the Pataphysics Times, which was prominently displayed in the window of the Kenmore Galleries on South 18th Street in Philadelphia, so that it could be easily read by passers-by. Printed on the sort of blue cartridge paper that is used for architectural plans in an edition of 200, which Bruton distributed throughout Philadelphia in an act of generosity that underscores his belief in the primary social nature of the artwork, this single sheet blueprint newspaper was based on a labyrinthine collage, of intersplice photographic reproductions, newspaper headlines, slogans, and snippets of found text clipped from a variety of sources. This transgressive broadsheet can be understood as Bruton's blueprint for an artistic revolution in Philadelphia based upon Jarry's science of imaginary solutions, as presented in his dauntingly dense masterpiece of anti-rationalism, Exploits and Opinions of Dr. Faustrol, Pataphysician. Bruton's blueprint newspaper, with its images of Alfred Jarry sporting a t-shirt bearing the slogan, Screw Good Taste, Lenny Bruce trying to find a cop who can read or write, and Jean Dubuffet's portrait of Antonin Artaud shouting shit to the world, merde au monde, represents a humorous synthesis of the absurd and the rational. Like a veritable roadmap to pataphysics, the blueprint newspaper contorts external reality through a complete embracement of contradiction and paradox, as seen in Jacques Prévert's weather forecast, which predicted foul-smelling showers and clouds filled with excrement, which would slowly turn into heavy torrents of shit later into the afternoon, especially over the city of Philadelphia. In a delightful pun on Urdu, Bruton claimed to have translated Prévert's weather report from Urdu and clearly enjoyed the scatological aspect of Jarry's writings and those satraps who followed in his footsteps. In the spring of 1965, following the success of the Kenmore Gallery's exhibition, which Andy Warhol, by the way, had attended while in town for his retrospective at the ICA, Bruton returned to Denmark, where he had another successful solo exhibition at the AP Gallery in Copenhagen. This exhibition, which opened in May 1965, again reveals Bruton's obsession at that time with Jarry's concept of pataphysics. In the exhibition brochure, Bruton declared, "Pataphysics is the science of imaginary solutions. To the pataphysician, only the comic is serious. We can understand the logic of Alfred Jarry's tripod." It has four legs. After all, a tripod with three legs has something missing. Pataphysics is as far beyond metaphysics as metaphysics is beyond physics. It is the science. This statement reveals that Bruton had not only read and absorbed exploits and opinions of Dr. Falstroth, pataphysician, but had found a way to apply what he described as its, or what we often describe as its ineluctable logic, to his own artistic practice. The reference to Jerry's tripod, a wooden cabin-like residence that, according to his friend and patron Rashield, rested on four masonry pillars, for example, is exactly the kind of comically serious pataphysical notion that would fuel Bruton's imagination and creativity for the rest of his all-too-short life. While earlier paintings like Alfred Jarry of 1962 reference Jorn's swirling painterly abstractions of the Cobra period, Bruton's subsequent works, such as Pata Target, reveal the creative excitement at this pivotal moment in the artist's career, when despite his financial struggles and frequent bouts of depression, Bruton enthusiastically spread the word about pataphysics to his fellow Philadelphians through his paintings, prints, publications, slogans, and stamps. He even planned to launch a Pata comic on April 1, 1965, based on Jerry's Le Sumal, although its non-appearance suggests that it may have been designed all along as an April Fool's Day joke. On May 15, 1967, Bruton's work was included in a group show featuring the work of four Philadelphia-based artists at the Socrates Parakis Art Gallery in Philadelphia. Organized by the graphic and performance artist Jim McWilliams, the exhibition also showcased the work of Tom Chimes, who we heard about from Mary, and Paul Anthony Greenwood. Bruton was almost certainly responsible for the exhibition's grandiose title, The Society for the Commemoration of Festivals and Fetishes. That's an exhibition you're going to see. And it reflects the which reflects the numerous official-sounding societies and institutes that his friend Asger Jorn had founded across Europe. I also suspect that Bruton may have been behind the idea to have the exhibition opening at midnight, which was billed as a pure party and was attended by literally hundreds of people. Unfortunately, the exhibition opening was overshadowed by Bruton's suicide 3 days earlier, when emotionally unstable, financially impoverished, and suffering from spinal problems and alcoholism, he shot himself with the rifle he was issued in the Korean War. The former Marine sergeant was just 36 years old. Many people who attended the opening viewed Bruton's suicide on May 11, 1967, from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, as akin to the French writer's own self-induced demise in a haze of luminiferous ether and alcohol. However, Bruton's death does not strike me as a cheap publicity stunt, but rather the result of a lifetime of coping with depression, illness, and poverty, since he refused to teach, believing that a true artist should devote all of his or her available time and energy to making art. This heroic stance often cost him dearly, since his income from the odd jobs that he did take on to survive was so meager that he could often not pay his rent. As Harry Kolkowitz, the director of the Kenmore Gallery, succinctly stated at the time, "We feel that Jim was one of the great talents to emerge from Philadelphia institutions like the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and his death may be attributed in great measure to the lack of encouragement and subsidy for artists like him." Two memorial exhibitions were held in quick succession, the first at the Peale Galleries of the Pennsylvania Academy in 1968, where Bruton's work was shown alongside that of Robert Rauschenberg. And 3 years later, the Kenmore Galleries organized a memorial show in which proceeds from the sale of paintings and works on paper were used to establish the James E. Bruton Student Aid Fund to benefit needy graduates from the Pennsylvania Academy, thus giving them the sort of financial aid that was unavailable to Bruton during his lifetime. In her review of Bruton's 1971 memorial show, Nessa Foreman, the art critic of the Philadelphia Inquirer, wrote, "There was an artist who was ahead of his time, who was brilliant, sensitive, and nonviolent, who loved his art and just wanted to paint. Bruton was into conceptual art before the term was coined. Ironically, his graffiti paintings and lithographs hold more insight and value for us today than when he painted them." 4 decades later, this prophecy still holds true. Yet, as I hope to have made clear, in order to grasp the full significance of Bruton's work around us, one needs to understand the reception of Alfred Jarry's notion of pataphysics among the revolutionary cultural organizations of the post-war avant-garde and the defiant, inspirational example of Asger Jorn, who, like a modern Falstroth, guided aspiring artists like Bruton on their creative pataphysical journey.